This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Colonel Guy Roberts, retired USMC Colonel, though I can't say former, I know better. Colonel Roberts is a member of ASP's Consensus for American Security, and up until August of 2011 was the Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Weapons of Mass Destruction Policy and Director of the Nuclear Policy Planning Directorate for NATO. Colonel Roberts, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So I've been excited about this podcast because we're going to talk about some pretty big issues, as I said before we started, NATO and nukes, but of course in the context of what's happening now and our relationship with our allies. So there's been a lot of changes on the nuclear front and NATO too. So I'm wondering, mm-hmm. maybe that's a good place to start. What's the world look like to you right now?
Well, the world looks very chaotic at the moment. And I think there's really a lot of challenges, many of which didn't really rise to the surface while I was at NATO. I still remember very well back in 2005 when I first came to NATO, where we were actually, believe it or not, talking about Russia joining NATO.
And how strange.
We even had a meetings on what we call the Membership Action Plan, which wow. is the process by which countries become members of NATO, one which will become a member at this next summit in July, Montenegro. Huh. Although you might want to ask me, what does Montenegro contribute to the NATO alliance? But nevertheless,
yeah, we'll get there.
we will have 29 nations by wow. the end of this year. So, and we had a very robust and cooperative relationship with Russia on many fronts. Mm-hmm. We had the NATO-Russia Council, of which there were several subcommittees, one of which was nuclear, which I chaired. I also chaired one on theater missile defense. Mm-hmm. And I have to say we had a very good collegial, cooperative, collaborative relationship with the Russians. We, in the NATO nuclear side, we did four incident-accident exercises.
Wow.
The Russians did the first one, and then the U.S., France, and the U.K. all did these exercises that demonstrated their capabilities in the event of a terrorist attack or a accident with involving nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. Very, very open with their procedures, the Russians. In addition, we had two NATO-Russia nuclear doctrine seminars in wow. which the Russians were very candid and open about their military nuclear doctrine. We had a very robust discussion. Actually, all four nuclear weapon states within the NATO-Russia Council gave presentations. So I was quite excited about the building this relationship. And then in 2007, we had, unfortunately, a major cyber attack against Estonia mm-hmm. that originated in Russia. And many still believe that it was one that was encouraged, if not, in fact, conducted by the Russian government. Mm. And then in August of 2008, we had the invasion of Georgia,
right.
which again put the relationship, started to build a very icy,
fray a little at the edges.
confrontational type of a relationship. And then I guess you could say the rest is history to where we are now back to what clearly is an adversarial relationship in many areas. Even though we do have some areas where we do cooperate, terrorism would be one. Mm-hmm. Another would be non-proliferation initiatives. But with this new assertiveness by the Russian government, now we are focused on, again, a more traditional NATO role of defending our allies on the borders of the alliance, and mm-hmm. and so that's a different kind of picture, if you will, than when I was at NATO.
So I guess from when you were at NATO and as compared to now, we've talked obviously a little bit about the change with Russia. How has our relationship with our other allies changed, if at all?
Well, there has been, I think, a change in our relationship. It's, focused around these new threats. Part of it has to do with the globalization of these kinds of threats, mm-hmm. focusing on the terrorist threat, number one, which if you look at the various statements at the summits that we've conducted over the last years, routinely the alliance will pronounce that the greatest threat to international peace and security is the threat of nuclear terrorism or weapons of mass destruction terrorism writ large, mm-hmm. Possibly a biological attack or so on. So that's clearly there that we all recognize as being probably the greatest threat to international peace and security. I don't think we've taken enough steps to address that. On the one hand, the alliance came up with a comprehensive non-proliferation policy that was agreed to at one of our summits. Actually, it was at the anniversary summit of the alliance in Strasbourg, Kiel, in which we agreed to basically a whole range of measures to deal with this phenomena of WMD terrorism. Mm-hmm. It was your classic, you're authorized to do all of these things, but we're not going to give you any money.
Well, but that would be too easy if we gave you the money.
Right. So it's been a struggle. We have we established a center of excellence in Vyshkosh, the Czech Republic, mm-hmm. on CBRN, which is a center that is hosted by a government in which other nations can contribute. For example, we have an American that's based there, and other countries have provided personnel. We have a Center of Excellence on Defense Against Terrorism in Ankara that focuses on the terrorism phenomena and the WMD terrorism aspect. So we have these kinds of capabilities to deal with the proliferation threat and the terrorism threat, but we've severely undercut it from a funding standpoint, and I think that's really a huge challenge. The other aspect is there's a north kind of south orientation towards concerns right now. Mm. The north, of course, in the Baltic countries, Poland, along our periphery, have grave concerns about Russian adventurism, if you will.
That's such a polite way of putting it.
The southern countries are really more concerned about the current migrant/refugee issues and writ large, the problem of international criminal organizations and terrorism that we continue to see occurring. And, of course, I don't need to go into the Paris attacks, the attack in Brussels and so on, in which, again, there's really, really great concern about trying to deal with that. The struggle that the Europeans have is the fact that they focus more on law enforcement mm-hmm. working these issues than the military. And it's been very, very challenging for them to have this, to break down, if you want to call it, rice bowl of law enforcement and the military and building cooperative relationships. And that's no more evident than in the area of trying to share intelligence, not only between these organizations within your own country, but also internationally. And it's a challenge that we at NATO have had to struggle with. Mm-hmm. Part of that has to do with a couple of really bad cases of espionage. Mm. One of the worst ones we've ever had occurred while I was there, actually, involving an Estonian who passed everything he got to the Russians. So that then made it very difficult on a multilateral basis to share intelligence.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of the biggest, since it is indeed the front line for dealing with terrorism, is having good intelligence.
Right.
And we've seen how the problems the Belgians have had
of
sharing that intelligence. And so we continue to struggle with that. On a bilateral relationship, it's usually not that difficult, but in this multilateral area where you lose control, then it's much more of a challenge. And so we really need to work more, try to develop that as well. As far as the alliance as a whole goes, one of the changes that occurred from the Bush administration to the Obama administration was more of a feeling or an attitude of all 28 countries being equal, so to speak. The United States, in my opinion, took more of a back seat role. They even kind of announced it at one point, saying we're going to lead from behind.
I do remember that.
You remember that?
I do. I was significantly younger than I am now, and I don't think I understood it then, and I'm pretty sure I don't understand it now.
Well, you know, it kind of manifested itself in NATO, in my view,
right,
by the fact that the U.S. didn't take the lead on a lot of issues. They were just one of 28 countries. And to be frank, I think that the alliance needs American leadership to go forward. It needs someone to take the lead. And the U.S. has always done that in the alliance,
right,
as far as I have seen and observed. And this kind of change made it more difficult, I think, for the alliance to organize itself, to continue to fund itself at a rate that it politically agreed to, which was 2% of GDP to be spent on defense. And very few of our countries, I think only four, have actually met that 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably six or seven, maybe as many as nine countries that spend less than 1% on defense. And I think in the future, especially now, with the challenge of countries that aren't paying the full bill, we call them free riders.
Yeah, there's an economics term for that, the free rider problem, right?
Right, right. It does require a very strong American leadership. And that's part of the reason I'm very concerned about this current election, is that I think we ought to be having a dialogue and talking about the fact that allies matter.
Right.
Allies are important. Allies are important to our security. We will not go to war without allies in any circumstances. We need them to ensure our markets and world trade and collaborate on dealing with the problems that we see in the world today, whether it be international criminal activities, failed states, migration problems and issues. We need to work, and they look to us for, these various countries and our allies look to us for leadership.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that without allies, you know, the allies are what keep us from going to war, right? It's the strong intelligence sharing, cooperation, collaboration, like you said, the geopolitical aspects, the economic aspects. With isolationism, only leads to trouble.
Yes, I think that's true. And you know, if you are an aggressive country and you have aspirations, hegemonic aspirations in an area, the fact that the United States has a presence in that area,
right,
the fact that the United States provides a warning that if you cross a red line, dare I use that term? That's probably out of vogue now, red line.
We'll go with it.
That if you do cross this red line, you're going to have to deal with the Americans.
Yeah.
And just the fact that you have to deal with the Americans will, I think, deter certain countries from around the globe from acting the way they do. Probably a good example of that right now is, I think we're in a process of gathering allies together around the South China Sea.
Right.
I found
some very interesting phrasing by Secretary Kerry in the last couple of days.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So now we kind of partnering with Vietnam,
right,
which is a little bizarre for someone from lived through the Vietnam War.
Hey, anything can happen, right?
Right.
NATO and Russia could happen. Not now, but
no. We're back doing exercises with the Philippines.
Right.
And having a presence there. Obviously, we have our presence in Japan and South Korea. And even smaller countries are looking to the United States to rein in this effort by China to make the South China Sea a territorial water, and with their, you know, exclusive rights to do whatever they want there.
Right.
So I think we see this happening now about the fact that without Americans being in that area and doing that, then they know that China would be able to do whatever they wanted.
Right. Of course, American leadership does not necessarily mean, as you, of course, well know, bombs and bullets, right? There are other ways America can show leadership and be engaged. And a somewhat controversial example of that maybe is JCPOA, you know, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And I wonder, from your time at NATO, your experience with nuclear weapons and WMDs at large, did you ever think this was going to happen? And was it going to look like this from your perspective?
No.
Good
That's
answer.
The easy answer.
Yeah.
No, it was interesting that we went through this joint comprehensive plan of action with Iran that has no legal basis.
I mean,
it's simply a plan of action. You do this, we do that, and hopefully, you know, we get to
That's
this
fine.
Kind of end state way down the road. An end state that doesn't really end, in my view, Iranian aspirations for nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
It simply kicks the can down the road, where the hope is, I assume, that at that particular point, the Iranians would see the error of their ways and decide to completely forgo any
weapons.
Kind of
yeah.
Nuclear weapons program. I think that's a little Pollyannish, to be frank. We continue to see the Iranians heavily engaged in terrorist activities and supporting terrorist groups. We continue to see them developing their robust ballistic missile capabilities,
right.
A capability that will allow them to develop an intercontinental ballistic missile. They've
right.
already launched a couple space vehicles into space, so they're getting closer and closer to that, and they have the technology and the capability to miniaturize and weaponize. And when you look at the tests that they're doing, one cannot help but come to the conclusion that the warhead for these longer range missiles would indeed be a nuclear one.
Mm-hmm.
Although the Russians or the Soviets in the old days did experiment with an ICBM, with a bioweapon,
right.
and even a chemical weapon, that didn't prove that practical, but it is always possible that could be another capability as well. But primarily, I think we're still looking at an Iran that has aspirations for nuclear weapons. They certainly have hegemonic aspirations in the Gulf region, which,
sure.
of course, leads us to have worries about a cascading effect.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries that have said or intimated or, you know, whispered that if the Iranians actually do get this capability, then they want to go down that path as well.
Right.
Which, again, getting back to what I said earlier, that's exactly why the United States needs to make and have a very robust presence in the Gulf and to continue to assure our allies that they will be protected from any kind of activities by the Iranians.
And what do you think that presence looks like? Is it kind of boots on the ground? Is it more along the lines of a lot of these mill-to-mill operations you talked
mm-hmm.
about with Russia and NATO? Is it more diplomatic and state dinners? I mean, you know, cherry pick. What do you think it looks like?
Well, I certainly am an advocate of 96,000 tons of military hardware on an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
That has a certain cachet for a very hard power diplomacy.
Sure.
Just presence works. I think it does work. Just the
yeah.
fact that we're there and actively engaged, and it could be across the spectrum. I certainly think that in order for soft power to work, you do have to have an element of hard power.
Right.
You have to know that
you're
indeed,
not all jello. Yeah.
Exactly. And so it's a combination of things, you know, building relationships, building the whole, collaborative work with defensive relationships. Within NATO, we have something called the Mediterranean Dialogue, in which we have seven nations in the region, Jordan, forget all of that. I think the Algeria, Morocco, Israel, and which we exercise together, help them build capability so that they can work with NATO forces.
Sure.
But back in my day, the Russians even participated.
Right, and you had and you were saying you understood pretty clearly what it was they were doing and how they were doing it.
Right.
And you could call somebody up on the Russian side and say, hey, I have a question about, you know, whatever your hard power non-jello option is.
Exactly.
And maybe we don't have those capabilities as much with Russia now, but
right.
we have them in other places, yeah? And they're important.
They really are. They really are. And I think that when you have a military presence in the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
then again, and it's not to say that we won't be challenged, because right. there will always be an attempt to say, well, how far can we push them?
Right.
And you know, there are these asymmetrical attacks
right.
that we have to deal with and always will. I mean, I remember when the USS Stark was hit by a terrorist attack, Khobar Towers. So we know these things are there, and frankly, it's quite likely, almost inevitable, that we will continue to see those
right.
kinds of things. And we don't have to overreact, but we do need to react. And
mm-hmm.
we need to make sure that those that support those kinds of acts will pay a terrible price.
Right.
And hopefully that price is more than they're willing to bear.
Right.
And that's so that's the hard power aspect of it. But to get there, you need to make sure that you have a very clear message that you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
Part of the getting back to that agreement with Iran, my frustration with that is not so much the details, although there are a lot of issues and questions that I think that need to be clarified, and we'll see how things really play out. But it was the fact that we never addressed the Iranians on all the other issues that we have with them, especially the fact that they were the number one sponsor of terrorism.
Right.
And the ballistic missile program.
Right.
And to be frank, their human rights record, which
right.
is one of the worst in the world.
It's terrible.
And, you know, I just reject the idea that, well, they won't talk about it. Because, again, I feel like I'm showing my age here, but
it wasn't always this way.
Well, no, and you go back to our relationship with the Soviet Union. We had, in Helsinki, we created a basket, three separate baskets. One was arms control, dealing with the arms control relation. The other was on dealing with human rights issues. And the other one was social economic factors and things like that. And many would argue that the fact that we really pressured them on human rights, that was a real big reason why we ended up having the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we were willing and we were determined to address those other issues and not just focus on the arms control side. Now, if we could have done that with a entity that was an existential threat to the United States, why couldn't we have done that with a country that is not?
Right.
And so I think we shortchanged ourselves by not pressuring the Iranians on human rights, on the terrorism issue, on the ballistic missile program. And now, of course, what do we see? You know, their human rights record is even more atrocious.
Right.
I don't know how many people they've executed for crimes that we wouldn't consider crimes.
Right.
I don't know how much further their ballistic missile program has gone, but they've been launching quite a few.
Right.
And of course, they are very actively engaged in supporting groups like Hezbollah and others that continue to commit these atrocities. Why couldn't we have addressed that with them in that dialogue? And I think we could have, but maybe those negotiations would have taken longer. But at the end of the day, I think we would have had a much better relationship with Iran if we'd have done that.
So, Colonel Roberts, we ask all of our guests the same last question. And in your case, I'm going to split it into two. So,
right.
of course, our last question is, what's next, right? So 20 years down the road, if we pick, one option A or option B, where do we end up? And so I ask first, in the context of our relationship with our existing allies and soon-to-be allies, if we do it right, where does it leave us? And if we do it wrong, where does it leave us? And the second part of that question, which to me there's a connection, is when we look at JCPOA and the framework we've used to build something or the start of something with Iran, and you think about, as you just did, some lessons learned from negotiations and progress with the former Soviet Union, how do we proceed? You know, what does the world look like 20 years from now in the context of our relationship with our allies and also with Iran?
Well, I've never been very good in predicting things.
That's probably not true.
I keep reminded of that old saying by Yogi Berra, the future ain't what it used to be. So that is a real challenge. I would certainly hope that at looking out 20 years, we have a very strong, integrated, fully collaborative relationship with our partners and within NATO and in other parts of the world, that those relationships would be such that we have open and free trade relationships, a interoperable military in all levels, that we have a meeting of the minds. Right now, another one of the problems with NATO, and I don't mean to keep harping on problems, but
they're important to talk about.
They are, but they lack, I believe we lack currently, intellectual interoperability.
Mm.
We don't. Interesting. We're not on the same
wavelength.
Page, our wavelength, and that's a real challenge. I mean, we still have reluctance to address and face up to the fact that we need nuclear weapons as part of our deterrence posture within the alliance,
mm-hmm.
that they serve a very political, not military, purpose that we need to acknowledge. And sometimes it's very difficult to get Germans or Dutch or Belgians, for example, to actually, in a public forum, talk about the need for having that deterrent to deal with the full spectrum of threats that we face. They're happy to talk about nuclear weapons in the context of global zero, coming up, finding a way to develop a nuclear weapons convention that would abolish nuclear weapons for all time.
Good luck.
Good luck.
An honorable dream that we all subscribe to, but
But in the real world, that is a necessary part of our deterrence posture to ensure we don't end up with another great power war.
Absolutely.
So I would hope that we'd have a more honest debate and discussion, and that the populations would recognize that this is important for their future and safety and security. And I'm hopeful that we would have that done. And frankly, given the political situation now, I think these countries are recognizing when you have a Russia that threatens to nuke Denmark, to conduct exercises that end with a nuclear detonation in Poland, and then threatens to put nuclear weapons in the Crimea or in the Kaliningrad Oblast and make those kinds of nuclear saber-rattling sounds, that there is this utility and need to have and ensure the other side understands that we have a nuclear response. So a more honest and open relationship that where we can say that our 24% of that budget that we spend on our allies is well worth it, and that we reduce the free ridership, if you will, and that the countries that do develop this interoperable military and diplomatic relationship are indeed fully capable. All too often, many of these militaries are kind of a jobs program. They're there to do work, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are capable and competent soldiers. And so sometimes I wonder about that. But you know, again, given the dangers of the world today, I don't see any change that's going to happen in the Middle East. In fact, I think that situation is going to get worse over time. It's very hard to try to figure out how to get Shiite and Sunnis together that, in a way that aren't going to continue to slaughter each other. Which far more of those are dying than Americans or Europeans.
Absolutely.
What they're doing, and likewise, the continual issue about Israel. Is going
forever
to 20 years
always.
From now. I think there's at least two more Nobel Peace Prizes
to
be won.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking at least two, probably more like six.
Right.
But
because that's going to continue on until those nations in that region are willing to accept that Israel has a right to exist.
Right.
And frankly, if they would do that and sign a peace treaty, I think all options are open from the Israeli standpoint. So I think, but I don't see it happening, unfortunately. I've actually done some work on a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, and it just right now it's just very, very difficult, if not impossible, given the turmoil. Hopefully we won't have that kind of turmoil that we're having now with states in Syria and Iraq and with this Islamic State problem. Hopefully that'll be gone.
So I
looking back in history and looking forward, I see more of the same. I see a chaotic world where we're going to continue to have tensions and conflicts, but it will not be on a level that we've had in the past, like World War II, for example, or, right. or World War I. But we will have continue to have these kinds of conflicts as countries have aspirations for more territory or more whatever, and we're going to continue to have this phenomena of failing states, states incapable of adequately governing themselves, which will then, nature abhors a vacuum, so we'll have terrorist groups or international criminal organizations. And you know, that's the other aspect that we didn't have in the past, and that's the globalization of technologies.
Right. It's a different world now. You know, I was thinking when you said earlier, there's, the fear of international criminal organizations or terrorist groups obtaining using nuclear, chemical, biological weapons. That seems relatively new, a rather new threat, and a terrifying one nonetheless, but an interesting twist.
Yeah, the terrorist movement. The use of terrorism is not anything new. In fact, the antecedents of the terrorism we experience today go all the way back to the anarchists in the 19th century. And one of the things that they did is they embraced new technologies back then. In fact, I've got a letter I found of a anarchist that he wrote to Alfred Nobel thanking him for inventing dynamite. So they could blow up more people and more things and so on and so forth.
I wonder if I know that person.
But, in fact, they were actually much more effective. I believe they killed 8 heads of state.
Wow.
Including one of our presidents.
That's right.
He was killed by an Italian anarchist.
That's right.
And they, you know, they almost got our attorney general. They almost got J.D. Rockefeller. There was the first vehicle-borne improvised explosive device was in the 1920s in Wall Street. Again, an Italian anarchist blew up a big bomb and killed many and injured hundreds, and you can still see the shrapnel marks on the buildings around there.
But
so there's nothing new here.
Yeah, it just has a new flavor.
And well, the new part is the globalization of information with Facebook and all the other types of things and the internet and the ready access to the technology where you had to do a lot of work in the past. Now you can Google something and find out how to make homemade bombs and do all the things you want to do. And you go down to Home Depot and you get all the stuff that you need. And
you're
good to go. So that's really, that rises, that gives these groups the ability to create chaos and havoc and change the way we live. Just look at getting on the airlines now.
Yeah.
And what it was like 40 years ago. It's a lot different. So we've got to deal with that, and that's probably the biggest change. In fact, I just gave a lecture last week on this problem of globalization and terrorism, and there's a fellow in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. In fact, he's got a website called jetman.com.
Jetman.com, okay.
And there's what he did. He made a jetpack. And he flies.
No one listening to this can see my face right now, I realize.
and it's an individual flight. He flies around.
Wow.
And so that's kind of really interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also frightening because now imagine 30 or 40 people with 40 kilos of explosives laced with plutonium or highly enriched uranium, and they simultaneously fly into 100 buildings or 30 buildings somewhere in some country, and which you could easily do. So, I mean, you have all this technology now that's readily available, and that's the biggest probably change. And that's going to be very difficult to get our hands on because, again, or find solutions because it keeps accelerating. You know, it just keeps getting faster and faster, and new things keep popping up that, again, groups that are determined to do evil will be able to do evil on a grander scale.
It's the whack-a-mole of peace and security, sounds like.
Right.
Well, Colonel Roberts, thank you for joining us. We will absolutely have you back. This is What's Next. I'm Maggie Van Der Velde.